The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, another response to Georgia Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones' request to the University System of Georgia regarding its 26 member institutions. Now, the Lieutenant Governor's request, he wanted to know how much the institutions are spending on DEI programs, including staffing and related university and community programming. Well, that sparked a lot of criticism in response. Last week, we heard from Georgia Democratic Representative Tanya Miller. Today, it's longtime educator Dr. Walter Kimbrough. Those conversations coming up. But first, this news. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta will scale back its reports on COVID-19 as the emergency declaration issued during the pandemic, well, it's come to an end. Meantime, the head of the CDC, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who was on the program many times, says the waning pandemic marked a good time to make a transition at the top, meaning she is stepping down from the job effective June 30th. The CDC, with its $12 billion budget and 12,000 employees, is charged with protecting Americans from disease outbreaks and other public health threats. In other news, Georgia now has a law that creates a commission that will discipline or can discipline or remove elected prosecutors. WABE politics reporter Raul Bali has more on Governor Brian Kemp signing the bill into law and the pushback.
The push for the bill was in part from Republicans who brought up local district attorneys and solicitor generals who said they would not prosecute abortion or low-level marijuana cases. And they point out the general handling of bail and cases.
They're giving dangerous criminals get-out-of-jail-free cards through their lack of professionalism. And their misguided priorities and poor leadership are driving experienced and talented prosecutors out of their offices.
Kemp, along with the Lieutenant Governor, the House Speaker, and a State Senate committee, will make appointments to the new Prosecuting Attorneys Qualifications Commission. Democratic Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis is an outspoken critic of the proposal, calling it racist.
I think for the first time in history, we have more minority elected DAs than we've ever had. Never have they done this. District attorneys have to have the discretion to be able to look at cases and make decisions. And the people are the only ones that put me in my seat. Governor Kemp did not put me in this seat. The voters of Fulton County did at a rate of over 70%. It should be the people that take me out of this seat.
Other district attorneys have threatened to legally challenge the commission. For now, the commission is set to begin to take complaints about prosecutors on October the 1st. Raul Bali, WABE News.
At least 8 so-called fake electors in Georgia have accepted immunity deals in an ongoing criminal investigation. The Fulton County District Attorney has been investigating efforts by former President Trump and his allies to overturn the 2020 election results, as we hear from WABE's Sam Greenglass.
After the 2020 election, 16 Georgia Republicans signed on to a slate of fake electors for Trump. They submitted a document to the National Archives, even though Joe Biden had won Georgia's electoral votes. The participants say they were told this was just in case Trump's legal challenges prevailed, but prosecutors believe this was part of an unlawful plan to keep Trump in office. Last year, prosecutors told the electors they were targets of the criminal investigation. The immunity deals were revealed in a new court filing by a lawyer for the electors. DA Fani Willis says she plans to announce charging decisions later this summer. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
Clayton County residents now have access to free health stations in their public libraries. Dormia Vance reports from the county's main library in Jonesboro.
Scott Parham is the director of the Clayton County Library System, but he's not checking out books. He's checking out his health.
They say when you take your blood pressure, you should take it generally in the morning.
Parham is showing off one of the new health literacy stations just installed at a few of the county's libraries.
Make sure that the Velcro sleeve is firm but not too tight. And we push the button.
these stations were established to increase basic medical resources for communities of color. Parham says, speaking from his own experience, this type of access is important, especially for Black men.
They don't seek out their doctor, or they don't seek out medical care for themselves as they should. And we wanted to promote resources or avenues with which they could come to the library and do some things on their own.
The stations have a scale, glucose meter, and health books available too, plus exclusive internet access to medical sites. Summer Waters is a library assistant. She says the stations are convenient for library goers.
The first reaction I get is, oh wow, I didn't know the library could do that or have that. So it's a lot of just educating people on what resources we have here.
The stations were a part of a $20,000 grant through the network of the National Library of Medicine. Parham says the use of the stations is currently being assessed before considering any upgrades, but he's hoping stations can be installed throughout more city buildings. Dormia Vance, WABE News.
Finally, the Atlanta Braves center fielder Michael Harris II had one job when he came to bat in the bottom of the 12th Sunday against the Orioles.
Runners at first and second now for Michael Harris. Harris puts bat on ball. There's a drive to deep center field. And the Atlanta Braves are going to walk it off.
There you go. At the time of this original broadcast, the Braves have the second best record in the league with 24 wins and 11 losses. Yes, the Braves are playing some pretty good baseball at the moment, and just in time as another interleague series comes to town. This time it's the Boston Red Sox. Boo. Just two games Tuesday and Wednesday. First pitches tomorrow. Send me your emails. First pitches tomorrow inside Truist Park at 7:20. Meanwhile, my Cardinals are struggling. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Georgia Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones sent a request to the University System of Georgia's Chancellor Sonny Perdue. Jones wanted to know how much the institutions are spending on DEI programs. He wrote, quote, "I share the concerns expressed by various leaders and commentators and leaders of other states about the use of taxpayer funds by universities for this type of programming and the growth in administration spending on university DEI programs across the country in recent years." Goes on to say, quote, "These programs are particularly concerning when taxpayer funds are used to enforce the type of intellectual and political conformity that appears to be the hallmark of many campus DEI initiatives," close quote. That sparked a lot of criticism in response.
This idea that institutions of higher learning are these bastions of sort of liberal thought and indoctrination, which, you know, isn't true.
That is Georgia Democratic Representative Tanya Miller, recently on the program. So now let's welcome Dr. Walter Kimbrough, currently the interim executive director of the Black Men's Research Institute at Morehouse College. Dr. Kimbrough has an extensive career in higher education as it relates to research and advocacy, among others, also in advancing equity in higher education. Dr. Kimbrough, welcome to the program. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
I have Lieutenant Governor's letter to the chancellor. I take it you read it.
Yes.
And your initial reaction?
It's ridiculous. That's the only thing I could think. We're in this period of time when people are weaponizing words and concepts that they don't understand, like DEI, like CRT, for a political motive. And that's problematic. And so we're seeing this happen all across the country in higher education. And that's what I saw. I mean, and really he was upset because, you know, Governor or former Governor Perdue, now chancellor of the system says, I needed more money for higher ed. And so they're saying, well, you're complaining. Well, let's help you make some cuts. Mm-hmm. Let's start with this.
And we should note, so folks know, although Morehouse College is not part of the University System of Georgia, you as an educator in this area, you're saying, look, this is also sort of an alarm, you think, for perhaps some trend to start. Obviously, no one could put that on Morehouse College, right. But just in general, you see this as problematic.
Well, it is problematic. I mean, and I've worked at several University of Georgia system institutions, Albany State mm-hmm. and Georgia State, and a graduate of two, Georgia State and University of Georgia. So as an alum of the system and having worked in the system, I understand those issues that impact those institutions. So it could be detrimental for higher education in the state of Georgia.
I want to just get your thoughts on this, because there are these terms that folks, and let's be clear, that folks either get wrong or just don't know what they mean. DEI, CRT, even the colloquial woke.
Right.
Where is all this coming from, you think?
So there has been, I think, a very specific intent to say we're going to weaponize these terms. Christopher Rufo, who has done a lot of work with DeSantis in Florida, has been on a national stage the last few years saying, I'm definitely going to use these terms and give them new meanings. He was very deliberate about it and has done a great job. I was noticing this weekend there was an interview that former Secretary DeVos did on Fox News, and she was complaining about the history scores that are dropping for kids. And she said they're too busy teaching DEI and CRT. And it's like those scores started dropping in 2014. And she also wanted to blame the 1619 Project. And so, you know, I'm an educator. She's supposed to be one. I did a search with the Washington Post just to see how many times this critical race theory appeared in the Washington Post. And in 2018, it didn't appear at all. In 2019, it only appeared once. Mm-hmm. But by 2021, it appeared 287 times. So over the last couple of years, and the same thing, I did the same kind of search with Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Mm-hmm. You didn't see it at all. But then 2021, 64 times, and 2022, 92 times. So there's been this deliberate weaponization of terms to scare people, to say the country's changing. We're seeing this, you know, new majority that's developing, and we don't have a place in it. So we need to go after these terms and these opportunities for people of color.
Speaking of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, you penned an opinion piece in the AJC in regards to Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones and his request. And you said, quote, basically you said, look, he wants to get rid of the black stuff.
Exactly. These terms really have become the nice way to use the N-word. That's really what it is. And so it's about
That's a heavy charge.
Yeah, it
Dr.
is.
Dr. Kimbrough.
I believe it 100%. It's about people of color. It's about the LGBTQ community. But that's what it means, because people don't really. He's not going to explain CRT and talk about Kimberly Crenshaw. He's not going to go into the depth of that work. This is just to say, let me scare people. This is all the black stuff. Black folks, LGBT folks are getting all kinds of things that my kids, and you know, that's what he says. I'm a sixth generation Georgian. I'm like, well, heck, I can't go back six generations. You want to know why? But you don't want me to talk about the history of why I can't even go back six generations.
You believe that at the core of this, it is Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, that this is motivated by a biased approach to teaching about diversity and equity and inclusion.
Yeah, absolutely. All of these are issues of saying we're going to hide part of the history of this country, which is very important, but it's driven by the changing demographics in the country, which creates a fear for people. And so you have particularly one party that's saying we don't even like the diversity on college campuses and how students are able to work together in diverse groups. So let's keep college students from voting. I mean, it's like if you're not like a very narrow group of people, we don't want you to have any role in the political process, which is problematic.
For folks who are listening who may not even understand. I had a guest on the program a couple of years ago when all this started, and it was a parent, and I asked her what she knew about CRT, and she was very fair. It sounded like she said, I don't know much. It's just what I hear.
Yep.
That is part of the problem.
That is it. No,
that's what you're saying.
That is, and every time you ask politicians to say, okay, really explain this for me. What do you mean by this? People can't give you a good explanation, so they don't know what it is. And I'm asking, give me the proof that people are being exposed, this is being taught, kids are being indoctrinated. I mean, when I think about indoctrination, I think about as a kid growing up and hearing about Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was, there was great indoctrination about what Christopher Columbus did and what the Indians did. All of that was indoctrination, and we didn't say anything. So now we're talking about an indoctrination that no one can even prove happens.
Would you welcome a conversation with Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones?
Oh, I'd love to.
Would you do it on this program?
I would do it on this program.
I'd just bring y'all together.
We could have the conversation. Just talk. We could have the conversation because he isn't being, you know, if the concern is the cost that we're spending because of the chancellor says, I don't have enough money, and he says, well, let's look to cut costs, why would you start there? Because in my op-ed, I said, if you want to start anywhere, let's start with football. Because every program in this state loses money on football except for the University of Georgia. And nobody ever suggests cutting football.
Here come the emails.
Right. Yeah, well, they might do it like that. But that's not even on the plate for anybody to say we're going to get rid of football programs. But that loses millions of money, as much as $20 million. So why would you cut maybe $1 million on DEI initiatives?
Or would you rather than for those programs that... Let's take UGA since you brought it up, because yeah. UGA probably gets a lot of revenue from not just tickets and concessions, but their apparel and licensing. Right. I've seen the mascot, I think, on, you know, pizza commercials, yeah, or whatever. So one could say you all have revenue strictly from stuff like that. But for other institutions, particularly smaller institutions, right, where if it's $500,000, $400,000, which this with this recent cut of $66 million, mm-hmm, that's a lot for an Albany or a small institution. You've been there. So
yes,
you know what a $500,000 cut to UGA may not sting as much as it does for one of those institutions.
Right. No, exactly. So, I mean, you have, you know, recently it was announced that they're doing some cuts of staff at Savannah State University. I mean, those are the kinds of institutions that in a Savannah State, which serves, you know, mostly black students, they're probably 70%+ Pell Grant eligible. When you start making cuts to institutions like that, you really hurt, you know, Georgians in a significant way.
And for state-funded HBCUs in general, which we know as a whole nother subject on that,
right,
in terms of revenue, you know, that's nothing new. You can ask Morris Brown about what happened, yep, when they lost their funding. They were, you know, just in terms of loans.
Right.
So for those state-funded HBCUs, Dr. Kimber, what advice, what would you tell them? How do you get through this?
Yeah, it's going to be a challenge. I think that everybody...
Because if there is any institution that's going to have a DEI program, it's probably going to be in Albany or something like that.
Well, not necessarily. When they're looking at those, yeah, they're looking at mostly predominantly white institutions that will have an office of diversity, a chief diversity officer. So you don't necessarily have those kinds of positions at the state HBCUs. And so their budget for DEI, and I've looked at it in the state of Florida, it's going to be much smaller. I would argue, though, as a public HBCU, your entire budget is DEI, because that's why you were
founded.
That's
where I was going to.
Yeah, it's everything you do.
Right.
So, I mean, nobody's done that, but I had a conversation with the Commissioner of Higher Ed in Louisiana, and we talked about this to say every state where they're asking for this, the public HBCUs to say, here's our whole budget. We dare you. We dare you to say you're going to close us because this is why we were created. This is what we do. So everything, present salary on down, all of it is DEI.
And how do you determine what is a DEI program if there's not a line item in the budget? If you bring in a scholar,
yeah,
or someone who happens to be a person of color,
right,
does that go under your DEI?
Yeah. So when they ask for that kind of data, it is very vague. And so institutions, I think, are determining how they want to couch that. Like I said, sometimes it might be an Office of Multicultural Affairs. They'll add that in there. Or if you bring in speakers that do that kind of program, you have specific DEI workshops, they'll add that in. So I think people have evaluated that differently based on the institution.
And I want to know what you started, because I get an email that says these kids need to spend more time in the classroom, not on the field. Look what you started.
Oh, look, I mean, I don't have a problem with it as well. I agree. And particularly because when you start looking at, you know, you want to talk about diversity, equity and inclusion. When you start looking at these institutions, what their student body looks like, and Sean Harper at the University of Southern California has done good studies on this. Mm-hmm. The black student representation, particularly for black men, doesn't reflect what it is on campus as a whole versus your football and basketball team. So you can find black men to generate revenue, but you can't find them to be scholars. So that's another issue that I have with some of this, too. If you want to deal with, you know, not have DEI, we need to, you know, deal with all these issues. So
what do you think in terms of by the way, I want to be fair, because we have reached out to Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones' office on a number of occasions. The last response that we received was that his office says he wasn't available today, but he's yet to respond to our follow-up email. So if there is a conversation to be had in moving forward, and with now the institutions maybe having to raise tuition, there's a trickle-down theory, there's a trickle-down effect here. So in the long run, what could this mean for some of these institutions, you think?
Well, like I said,
if they are forced to scale back or
right.
even cut.
Well, like I said, it impacts, I mean, the way that is targeted, I don't think it really has the public HBCUs in mind. It really is for, it would be of greater impact of a place like a Georgia State, mm-hmm. where they're going to do lots of different programs and multicultural programs because of the diversity of the institution. I mean, the largest group are Black students at Georgia State. So it impacts those institutions, and it impacts places that say, we want to have a diverse student body, so let's create some additional programs and opportunities to bring those students in because we want a student body that reflects the state of Georgia. So that's their aspiration. And people are saying now, well, no, you can't do that because then that you know, disenfranchises other people. Well, I don't understand how we start to think like that.
Well, and Georgia State has a new Center for Studies on Africa and its Diaspora, which before he left, then President Becker helped give a little funding for that. That's a program, that's a center that as far as I've been told, they are doing a lot, just not just dealing with DEI.
Right.
But because it's a center on Africa and its diaspora,
all of those things could be subject to questioning. And that's the problem. It's like there is no when a politician says we want to deal with all your DEI programs. How are you even defining that? Because they could come in and say, no, that's DEI. And they don't even know what it means.
When Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones writes that these programs are particularly concerning when taxpayer funds are used to enforce the type of intellectual and political conformity that appears to be the hallmark of many campus DEI initiatives.
Yeah, see, I wrote down the word taxpayer because it's almost like, well, who are the taxpayers? Because they're folks who look like me, about 38% of the state, that are also taxpayers. And it's almost like you don't even count. So it's like, well, what about those taxpayers that want to make sure that there is funding and programs so their children can go to these institutions and feel safe and feel secure and have a curriculum that reflects their interests? That's important, too. But he's not thinking about them as taxpayers.
And if he is also requesting job titles, job descriptions, salaries of full-time employees assigned to programs or in activities, what do you think that does for an educator?
Right. Well, it scares a lot of people. So you have, you know, particularly people who work in the multicultural affairs and student services, all of those positions. And probably one of the things that he doesn't realize, a lot of athletic programs have DEI people, too. People don't understand that a lot of athletic programs have people like that. So you're going to get rid of those folks. You're going to still have all these Black kids out there performing on the field, and you're not going to have the people there to do some of that work. That's problematic as well.
As we wrap up, what's been the response to your opinion piece?
I've heard from people who are just really glad that someone said some of those kinds of things. And like I said, it's not just here. It's happening all across the country that people have taken the Ron DeSantis formula and say, we're going to lean into these culture wars. And I think there are other things that we really could be working on together to strengthen higher education. But this is simply a culture war issue. And really, he's setting himself up to run for governor. So he sees DeSantis doing that. It's like, man, that works. I'm going to try it, too. That's all it is.
And again, you're willing to be in conversation with Lieutenant.
Would love to.
On this program.
Would love to.
We'll try to make it happen. Dr. Walter Kimbrough, currently the interim executive director of the Black Men's Research Institute at the Morehouse College. Congratulations to all your graduates. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. You just heard what longtime educator in higher ed, Dr. Walter Kimbrough, had to say regarding Georgia Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones' request to know in detail what the schools within the University System of Georgia, what they're spending on the DEI-related programming. Now, recently I spoke with Democratic Representative Tanya Miller, who shared her concerns. Representative Miller, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Rose. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
As you know, that $32.4 billion budget, which was approved by the legislature, includes a significant cut to the University System of Georgia, $66 million. Just first of all, your overall reaction to that?
Well, obviously that was disappointing. It was disappointing to us. It came very late in the budget process. Of the $66 million, the University System of Georgia is projecting that about $2 million of that will result in cuts to HBCUs, our state-funded HBCUs. So we have Fort Valley University, who is looking at about a $673,000 cut, Albany State, about an $832,000 cut, and Savannah State, about a $560,000 or so cut. These are obviously substantial cuts to our smaller institutions. I mean, it's not just HBCUs that will disproportionately bear the brunt of these cuts. It's our smaller schools, rural colleges. And so it's just very concerning for us to see that happening, especially at a time when Georgia has a significant surplus. The state is doing quite well financially, largely in part due to funds we got during COVID.
I have heard lawmakers over the years describe the University System of Georgia as, and I'm quoting here, the haves and the have-nots, in a sense. That's nothing new. When you look at some of the larger systems, institutions like UGA. Now, also, UGA is a larger institution maybe than some of the other ones, but they also have a very robust athletic department as well. I've heard folks go back and forth about all of that. So when Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones sends a letter, and I have the letter here that he sent to Chancellor Perdue, asking about the DEI initiatives and programs at the member institutions, when you first heard about that, your reaction?
Well, first, it was a little bit shocking that he sent that request in response to Chancellor Perdue criticizing the cuts to the university system. So it's almost retaliatory. It feels like it's retaliatory. And he's going after, in essence, diversity, equity, and inclusion programming. That's really what he was highlighting in that letter. You know, we are struggling to and fighting to increase diversity in our colleges and universities, particularly when it comes to underrepresented minorities, African Americans. So there's this double sort of whammy assault on HBCUs with the funding cut, and then what seems to be an attack, a gearing up to attack diversity and inclusion in our universities along the lines of what we have seen in Florida and other states. So it's just very troubling and disheartening to see this political culture war spilling in to our institutions that already struggle, really, Rose, to make sure that the student body represents the population in the state of Georgia.
I'm going to come back to DEI in a moment, but in the letter here to Chancellor Perdue and Lieutenant Governor Jones writes, quote, "I and other state leaders fully expect the university system will find the ability to live within its considerable means, which include over $500 million in reserves and more than $3.1 billion in unrestricted state funds appropriated to the system for the upcoming fiscal year." Response to that?
Well, I think that's sort of a red herring argument. One, 80% of that about 80% of that $500 million surplus belongs to the six largest institutions in the state, four of which are the big four, right? Our research institutions, UGA, Georgia Tech, Georgia State. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think Augusta University. So it really has almost nothing to do with the impact that these cuts will have on smaller schools.
On the final day of the legislative session, as you know, there was a great bit of debate regarding USG and its spending. Now, Senator Blake Tillery chairs the Appropriations Committee, and here's some of what he told the Senate.
Article 1, Section 8 that you asked about specifically. Article 1, Section 8 is extremely clear, and I'm glad you brought that up. There's a lot of comments about that this will be disproportionately impactful to smaller schools. That does not have to be the case. You see, what you brought up, Article 8, says that when we give money to the Board of Regents, the Board of Regents are in charge of how that will be done. It's essentially a block grant. So while you do see budgetary items and titles, teaching, Skidaway Island, other things under the Regents' budget, those things are program areas, but we block grant it to USG. They can spend it honestly any way they want. If they come outside of a program area, they will get an audit, a ding from the auditor. They'll send them a nasty letter and say you're supposed to be in this program area. But Overall, they are constitutionally allowed to spend that money when it comes to them as they please.
So, Representative Miller, if, in a sense, the institutions, they have every right to spend their money on what they deem are important for not only its student body, but for their institutions as a whole. Do you think Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones really understands that? Then why are you asking for this information? What do you need it for?
I mean, listen, I won't presume to get inside the mind of Burt Jones, but I will say that Chancellor Perdue has been pretty clear about this issue. You know, he has complied and will comply with this request. Frankly, it is his role constitutionally by the Georgia Constitution to manage the Board of Regents. And so this micromanaging that is happening at the Georgia General Assembly is really sort of misplaced energy. I think we have someone who is committed to doing what he believes is in the best interest of the Board of Regents. And we ought to be funding higher education. It's just the smart thing to do. It has significant workforce implications. And of course, as we talked about, you know, we have lucky to have state funded HBCUs in this state. So I would just urge the General Assembly and the governor, when we come back and revisit this budget, to amend the budget to replace these funds.
And we should note, Closer Look reached out to Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones' office. We have not got a response from anybody. And we're also working to try to secure an interview with Chancellor Perdue. I want to go back to these DEI programs for a moment as well, because in that letter to Chancellor Perdue from Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, he says, quote, talking about DEI, "These programs are particularly concerning when taxpayer funds are used to enforce the type of intellectual and political conformity that appears to be the hallmark of many campus DEI initiatives." He goes on to say, "In my view, rather than promoting the mission of public education, when used in this way, such programs inhibit the ability of colleges and universities to promote academic and intellectual freedom in both their course offerings and community events. I hope you and other leaders of our university system share these concerns."
Well, you know, I mean, we've sort of heard this is the same old song and dance that we are hearing from certain segments of the right and certain segments of the Republican Party. They are designed to get at this idea that institutions of higher learning are these bastions of sort of liberal thought and indoctrination, which, you know, isn't true. And I think he cited in particular an incident where some students protested a conservative speaker whose ideas they did not believe in.
That was, I believe, at Stanford University, I believe.
That's correct. And so, you know, this is part of what college is about. It's about the exchange of ideas. It's about protesting and free thought and teaching students to think freely and to speak up for themselves. And there is just, I don't think, any legitimacy to this idea that more diversity weakens our educational system. I think it's the opposite.
Have you heard from faculty and staff at these institutions who are concerned that they may be targeted or their programs may be targeted?
Well, yeah, there have been some institutions that have come out and publicly said, look, we think we are doing DEI exactly the way we're supposed to be doing it. It's successful. It's working. Our schools are successful. Our state is successful. We are, you know, we're not dealing with the brain drain that other states are dealing with in Georgia. So, you know, please let the higher education folks deal with higher education. And so I expect to see more of that and hear more of that. And I hope we do. If these legislators don't really do what they need to do and put this money back into the budget.
You have friends over on the Senate side. Is there any talk with someone or some type of other caucus or anybody sitting down with Lieutenant Governor Jones and talking this through?
Yeah, well, I think that now that folks like you and other people in the media are really focusing on this issue and what it means, we have heard both the head of appropriations in the House and Senate say that they are open to discussions that would find a way to replace the $66 million cut, which I think is good news. Mm-hmm. We will see what happens. Obviously, the governor supports, us, you know, returning this funding back to our institutions of higher learning. So I am hopeful. I'll say, that these conversations will continue, and we will get the funding back and more, because, you know, we're already operating at somewhat of a deficit as a result of enrollment being down after COVID. And so really, let's get this money back in with an eye towards particularly making sure our HBCUs and smaller schools have the funding that they need to stay afloat.
You mentioned the state surplus, which Governor Brian Kemp has been touting for a while now. Are there any other changes within the education system as a whole that you would like to see? I mean, we've had conversations about the Hope Scholarship and scholarships on merit and need and things of that nature. Any other initiatives that you think need overhauling within how Georgia regulates its education, public education system?
Oh, gosh, yes, absolutely. You know, we have had lots of conversations about the need to have some component of HOPE to be need-based so that it can reach more students. We have talked about expanding pre-K in the state of Georgia and you know, appropriately funding our public schools education in that way. We have talked about revisiting the QBE formula, which is decades old. Mm-hmm. The way that we fund public education is outdated and it needs to be revisited. So there are just lots of things that I think if you know, Democrats and other folks at the General Assembly had their way, we would be talking about and using the surplus to really invest back in the people of Georgia and our young people. Absolutely.
Georgia Representative Tanya Miller, we appreciate you taking the time on such short notice. Thank you again for taking the time.
Thank you, Rose. It was a pleasure to be here.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. We're now going to bring you a WABE News investigative feature that will begin today. Georgia law gives every tax commissioner the choice. When people don't pay their tax, the commissioners can collect the debt on their own, or they can get investors to do it for them. Of all the counties in Georgia, really only one has investors to do this, Fulton County. A WABE investigation now shows the cost. It puts investors in control of a process that can end with residents losing their homes, as we hear from Stephanie Stokes.
The property tax auction happens on the first Tuesday of the month, always outside the Fulton County Courthouse. The minimum is $2,650. Sheriff deputies stand near the courthouse doors and list off the properties for sale. The bid starts at the amount of taxes each owes. The potential bidders gather below. There are more than 50 people on this day, standing shoulder to shoulder on the courthouse steps. Others are on the sidewalk or spilling out into the street. The tax auction has grown with interest from new investors, thanks to videos like this one.
Hello, world.
A real estate agent, Keisha Thomas, trying to pitch people on her tax sale training. She introduces her brother
this
next to her.
Darren Gentles. He is my guinea pig, the first person who believed in me to purchase property on the courthouse steps.
They're walking away from the courthouse after a tax auction several years ago.
Because, tell him what happened, Darren.
We should have started.
She got him to bid, and he won. He holds up the paper showing that, a tax deed.
And here's the real deal, man. It's the real deal right here. There's no mortgage.
No mortgage because of what he paid.
Okay, how much did you pay for it?
$3,100.
$3,100.
And there's no mortgage downtown Atlanta.
$3,100 for a home near the center of Atlanta. Of course, these videos typically don't show the other side of the tax sale. And there always is another side. In this case, the property this man was so excited about buying, it was actually in a northwest Atlanta neighborhood called Dixie Hills. And it did belong to someone, Alicia Thomas's mom. In a bookstore in Clayton County, she tells me her mom lived there for 20 years.
My mom and her husband inherited the property.
The home had been in his family at least 60 years. It was a tiny bungalow, less than 900 square feet, but Thomas says her mom loved it. With the little inheritance money they had, they redid the floors and updated the kitchen.
I got new cabinets, you know what I'm saying? Oh, come and see, we put a deck on the back of the house, you know, come look at my flower bed.
They also repainted the house a couple times.
They did, put a lot of work into it and felt very, very proud of it. My mom felt like that was a blessing, you know, that she had inherited.
Her mom, an Atlanta native, had rented her whole life. She's now 70. This home was the first she ever owned.
She did not, absolutely did not want to leave that house.
WABE took a deep look at delinquent tax collection in Fulton County. We analyzed years of data. We found Black homeowners like Thomas's mom are almost always on the losing end. Of the more than 3,000 properties auctioned for taxes, 80% were in neighborhoods that for decades have been mostly Black.
It was shocking to see what a disparity it was.
Stacy Reynolds is an attorney at Atlanta Legal Aid.
I've certainly had enough clients that are in these areas, but I just kind of assumed that there was more in areas that just didn't come to us.
There are a lot of factors that could contribute to this disparity. These areas often had lower incomes, older homes. But another factor stands out too, the influence Fulton gives investors over the tax auctions. Reynolds knows this part of the system well. She's pushed against it for 20 years. Along with Frank Alexander, he's a former law professor at Emory.
Most counties, indeed, I think every county in the state of Georgia except Fulton County, collect their taxes, the delinquent taxes themselves.
Fulton is the only one to take this process and outsource it. So often, when people don't pay their tax bill, the county doesn't try to collect. Instead, the county takes the record of the debt, this is known as a tax lien, and sells it to investors. When Fulton hands over the tax liens, that puts the investors in charge. This is Reynolds again.
I mean, basically, they allow these investors to step into their shoes. The way it works is that they become the tax collector for these taxes.
The investors get to collect fees and interest from property owners. But they also get another power if property owners don't pay, one that in most counties is reserved for the tax commissioners. Alexander says because the investors hold the lien, they can choose to auction the property to recover their money.
Whoever holds the lien is just like a bank that holds a mortgage. If it's not paid, then they can enforce the lien by an auction, selling the property to a new owner.
Typically, they just have to wait a year. Unless the taxes are older, then the investors can move faster. This is how Fulton's tax auctions differ from other counties. The thousands of properties auctioned for taxes in Fulton, most were at the auction because investors put them there. Many were vacant lots or rental homes, but WABE found there were also stories of homeowners, like Thomas's mom. Thomas says her mom didn't even know the home was behind. Her husband had been in charge of property taxes, and he had been sick. He was struggling with cancer for 2 years.
So that was a loss of income, and she's trying to sustain the bills and, you know, trying to take care of whatever she can take care of.
Her husband died in 2016. Then her mom learned. He had missed several tax payments. The county had already transferred the tax liens on her property to an investor.
It was right after he passed that she started getting these letters and looking at these letters that she owed so much money on the home.
The total amount was under $3,000. Thomas says it was more than she and her mom could afford. So her husband died in January, and by August, the investor had the sheriff auction her home. She still could have reclaimed the property. Georgia gives homeowners a year, but at that point, they have to repay the winning bid plus 20%. And Thomas says that wasn't any more feasible than the original taxes. She remembers how hard it was for her mom to go.
Even up until the very day of her moving out, she wasn't completely packed. And I think that was just a part of her refusing to come to the realization that I have to leave this place.
Fulton County's tax commissioner, Arthur Ferdinand, declined an interview. He's defended the system in the past, though, almost since the time it started, decades ago in the 90s. He said it brings revenue to the county. After all, tax liens are just unpaid taxes, and when investors pay for the liens, they pay for the taxes. This, Ferdinand has said, is how he gets his collection rate so high. For years, it's been at 99%. But housing and community advocates have long said this isn't worth the trade-off.
It's beyond privatization.
Dan Immergluck is a professor at Georgia State University.
It's turning governance of this whole delinquent property tax system over to speculators.
He says these investors don't have an incentive to work with residents to keep their homes. WABE's findings confirm what their incentives are. The properties investors choose to auction are in mostly Black areas, but they're also in areas where real estate prices are rising fastest. They're the properties where there's the greatest potential for profit.
It's just incredibly mind-blowing that we have a public process that not only allows this to happen, but pushes it to happen.
Immergluck says it hurts the families who've been disadvantaged most. Homeowners in these places, most near the center of Atlanta, endured disinvestment for years. Only recently, with projects like the Atlanta Beltline, has there been a surge in development. Then these tax auctions happen.
It's taking property from folks who, through blood, sweat, and tears, earned that property. And then, you know, after decades of property values languishing, see the sudden rise in values, and it's gone.
Since the start of this system, one investor has bought most of the tax liens in Fulton County, a company called Investa. It did not respond to any of our requests. But to a tax law attorney, John Ayub, the company's actions make sense. He says the investors who buy liens pull out high-value properties for auctions because those are the properties that people will bid on, and that's how the lien investors get back their money.
So the system is designed for people to make money. Otherwise, people wouldn't do it, and then the taxes wouldn't be paid.
He says that system includes him. Ayub doesn't get involved with the tax liens, but he helps investors bid on properties once they go to auction. He says the new people who show up at the auction don't realize it's a risky investment. In case homeowners reclaim their properties, investors have to wait a year before they do anything. That's why the bidding prices are so low. Also, Ayub says the majority of houses at the tax auction are in very bad shape.
I'll be in a neighborhood, nice house, nice house, nice house. Oh, there's a house with the broken windows and the grass that's 5 feet long. That's the tax sale house every single time.
They don't have homeowners looking after them.
They're usually the house that's not being taken care of. That's been my experience.
In the occasional cases where there are owners in the property, he says, yeah, it is sad. Ayub has seen that. Someone loses their job or they have a disability. But in his mind, there will always be that side to tax collection, no matter who is in charge, the county or an investor. He's worked in this field for 20 years, ever since he was a Fulton County attorney representing the tax commissioner.
If you enforce the tax sales properly, they're going to be people who lose their homes. If you don't enforce the tax laws properly, your children are going to really crummy schools with flooded basements and rats running around.
That's the reality, he says. Local governments need property taxes to fund their services. But here's the thing. Other counties do manage to collect their taxes without doing what Fulton does. They may auction properties for unpaid taxes, but they don't sell off the whole tax auction process to investors.
The difference is that other counties...
This is Alexander, the law professor again.
The entire rest of the state of Georgia, the tax commissioners see that their job is to collect the taxes, but to do so in a manner that promotes the common good.
He says this is what it comes back to. Most tax commissioners, including Arthur Ferdinand, are elected officials. If Ferdinand believes his job is to collect bills, Fulton's system does that. But Alexander says other tax commissioners see a broader responsibility, to reach out to homeowners, to see what their situations are, to offer payment plans, to help them keep their homes.
The rest of the counties in Georgia say our job is to actually serve the people who might be losing their homes, rather than simply collect their taxes.
Fulton's tax commissioner does have a policy to not sell tax liens on homes with seniors. To qualify, though, they have to claim a tax break called a senior homestead exemption. Not all seniors do. Thomas's mom wasn't quite old enough. For families like hers, Reynolds, the attorney, says the consequences can be far-reaching. The tax auctions disrupt where they live, but also their ability to build wealth.
Generational wealth is such an important thing that the home is what most people have as their wealth to be able to pass on to their families. And you know, losing it to property taxes ends that.
The families only get whatever's left over from the auction, what's called excess funds. This is the winning bid minus the taxes owed. Reynolds says it's typically a fraction of the home's fair market value. Thomas's mom's house sold for so little, there was nothing left. The investor who bought her house, who you heard at the beginning, he didn't get back to us for this story. But years later, the home remains vacant. Tama says her mom sees it on their drives through the neighborhood. She's still dealing with the effects.
Losing the home, her church family, her community, everything that she's known for over the last 20 or so years.
Tama shows me some pictures of the time when her mom still had the home. As she goes through each one on her phone, I notice how much her mom is smiling.
This is really smiling, in photo
after photo.
She always smiling?
Thomas says,
that was back then.
She was a very, very happy person when she was in her own home.
Thomas says she doesn't see her mom smile like that much anymore. Stephanie Stokes, WABE News.
And we'll have part two of Stephanie's investigative series later this week on Closer Look. And that is it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. A reminder, let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. As always, send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it is online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. And also another programming note, as we continue to look at the rising costs of renting in Atlanta or the region, we'd like to know what your renting experiences have been like, from looking to getting to moving to whatever. Let us know. rose@wabe.org. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.